Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. As World War II was ending, Adolf Hitler cheated the hangman by committing suicide in Berlin. That left the men closest to him and other Nazi functionaries to pay the price for the Third Reich's war crimes and crimes against humanity. 21 of the most infamous would face justice in the first of the Nuremberg trials. An army chaplain from St. Louis was given the assignment of ministering to the spiritual needs of these men, men labeled monsters by the rest of the world. He was Lutheran minister Henry Gericke. He had ministered to criminals before, but none like these. What must that assignment have been like? Author Tim Townsend gives us the answer in his book, Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. Townsend is a former religion reporter for the Post-Dispatch, and he joins us now from NPR Studios in Washington. Tim, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Enjoyed your book. I'm not quite finished with it, but I'm fascinated by the story, and you've told it exceedingly well, I think.
Thank you.
Let me get to one of the main points that you make in this book, and it's clear from reading it that Henry Gericke was perfectly suited for the role he ultimately found in Nuremberg. Why was that?
You're right. He was perfectly suited. He had a very interesting position in time right as the Nuremberg trials were ramping up. The short answer is that he was Lutheran. He spoke some German, both from having been brought up on a farm in Cape Girardeau to German parents, and also from his time in school, in seminary, learning German and learning the Lutheran, at that point, Lutheranism and the Missouri Synod required its pastors to know German. So he knew some German. And he had worked in the St. Louis City jail system as a missioner during the Depression. He worked in a lot of a large swath of St. Louis as a missioner, but part of his ministry was in the St. Louis City jail system. So all those things kind of came together, and he happened to be in Munich right as the trials were beginning. And so the people who were organizing the trials found out his circumstance and his qualifications and his skills, and they gave him the assignment.
I certainly want to talk about that, but let's spend a little time talking about his time in St. Louis. One of the things that's very clear from the book is the total dedication he had to his calling and to the people he served.
Yeah, and, you know, it's, at some point, a lot of people might think to the detriment of his family. His kids really didn't see him very much because he was so focused on what he could consider saving souls. He was, as I said, brought up on a farm in Cape Girardeau, very badly wanted to become a pastor, which his father did not want. His father wanted him to be a farmer or a teacher. He said he would pay for him to go to school and be a teacher, but he did not want him to be a pastor. And so Gericke waited until he was an adult, essentially, until he was 18, to leave the farm. And then he went to Lutheran Seminary in Kansas and received his high school degree plus kind of a pre-seminary degree, and then came to St. Louis to go to Concordia Seminary to study. He eventually, when he was ordained, he was a pastor at a small church right in South St. Louis on Caroline Avenue, and he did that for a while. And you know, he was a good pastor. I think he just became bored after a little bit of congregational life. And so during the Depression, told his family that they were leaving the church, the sort of nice rectory that they had, and that they were going to find an apartment, cram into an apartment also in South St. Louis, and he was going to work as a missioner for the St. Louis Lutheran City Mission. And he was the executive missioner there, and he spent 10 years ministering to the insane asylums in St. Louis, the jails, as I said, and just people on the streets, until he was about 50 years old in 1943, and that's where the kind of war part of the story begins.
Yeah, and it's so St. Louis, we have to mention that he met his wife, Alma, when she was working at Famous Bar. Of course, it would have to be the case.
Of course, yeah. And his family, so the Gerickes had three sons, They also lived with Alma Garrickey's little sister and her parents. So all of them lived together in a tiny apartment above the first Werenbergs, which at the time was at the corner of Cherokee and, let's see, what would that be? Cherokee and, I'm missing my cross streets, but it's a tiny little apartment above what was Werenberg's Tavern, which was the first, which what began the Werenberg movie empire. It started as a tavern where Mr. Werenberg would show movies right after the St. Louis World's Fair. So there's a lot of good St. Louis kind of detail in the beginning of this story.
Yeah, there's no question about that. He was in his 50s when he decided that he was, in fact, going to enlist in the Army. How difficult a decision was that for him and his family in particular?
It was easy for him. He wanted he wanted to take part. He had, as I said, three sons, two of whom were already fighting in the war. This was 1943, and the U.S. had been at war for about a year and a half. And he was itching to go. He wanted to do his part. He was I think he was 49 when he decided to do this. And it happened that the U.S. was desperately in need of chaplains at that point. There was a chaplain shortage. We had so many men fighting that the chaplains were desperately needed. And so the age restrictions were bumped up to allow older men to enlist. And so Garrickey decided he wanted to do that, made all the arrangements beforehand, got all of his ducks in a row and figured out exactly what recommendations he needed and made it all sort of happen. And as soon as he knew that it was about to happen, he told his wife about it, who was not very happy because she already had two of the four men in her life were already fighting in Europe. But this was what he wanted to do, and Garrickey was pretty bullheaded, and when he wanted to do something, he was probably going to do it.
Well, he was not only leaving his family behind and his community behind, he was leaving those weekly sermons on KFUO behind as well.
Yeah, that's right. He was he had a great voice for radio, and he was also a very good preacher, and he did a little bit of a weekly radio called Moments of Comfort, and this was just a little bit of scripture with some heartening thoughts behind it that was on KFUO, but he was successful enough that KMOX tried to recruit him away from KFUO, mainly just because of his voice. They didn't necessarily want the religious part of it. They just thought he was a good broadcaster.
Well, this is the point, I guess, with all those other radio stations being mentioned, that I should say that folks are listening to KWMU just so we don't get lost in the shuffle.
Right.
Tim Townsend, from here, was off to England, where he spent some time. But let's get him to Germany. He went from England and spending some time there at a hospital, which was fairly busy, given the fact that this was about the time of the Normandy invasion and a lot going on in Europe. But let's get him to Munich. I'm particularly interested in his feelings about Dachau, which is just a few miles outside of the city. That was a concentration camp, and basically it housed prisoners from Eastern Europe, some Allied service people, and political prisoners from Germany. He was fascinated by that.
He was. He had, he had spent his war in a military hospital, mostly ministering to doctors and nurses who were part of the hospital, but also to men coming home wounded coming home and in a sort of a triage situation. So he had seen the horrors of war very, very much up close, but when the hospital moved down through France and into Germany after the war, they set up in a hospital, bombed out Munich hospital, and Garrickey and, another chaplain, his assistant, spent a lot of time going to Dachau. He said that they went several times, and wrote later, and I don't know if this is a figurative or a literal what he was said, but he said he would touch the walls at Dachau and his hands would come away smeared with blood. So he knew very much what had happened there, and so when he was given the assignment for Nuremberg, he knew exactly what he was up against.
although he never did fully explain why he kept returning and why it was such a fascination to him.
No, he didn't. I think, knowing a little bit about him, having sort of spent the last 6 years with him, I think he was interested in the absolute horror that man could produce against man. And I think he used that in a way in his ministry once he got to Nuremberg.
And you and your research for the book have also visited places of horror like Dachau, and you've had, as I understand it, similar kind of experience, experiencing that kind of place.
Yeah, the other chaplain. So in Nuremberg, Gericke was the main chaplain. He had an assistant chaplain who was a Catholic, Father Sixtus O'Connor, who was from upstate New York. And O'Connor was in charge of the handful of Nazis who were acclaimed Catholicism. He had he was not in a hospital during the war, but he was with the 11th Armored Division as a chaplain, fought through the Battle of the Bulge, and then with the 11th wound up at Mauthausen concentration camp, liberating that camp and burying thousands of bodies in the first days. So he went directly from that scene of Mauthausen directly to ministering to the people who were in charge of the concentration camp system. So I went to visit Mauthausen. I was there on a liberation anniversary, and it was striking to see both men who had been imprisoned at Mauthausen come back wearing often the striped pajamas that they had to wear, celebrating decades later with the American enlisted men who liberated them.
It's really hard to imagine the kinds of things that would be going through the minds of the two chaplains who had visited these places and then suddenly find themselves with these, and initially it was 22, but ultimately 21 of these Nazis who were being tried.
Yeah, Gericke was afraid. He when he was given the assignment, he was also given the opportunity to turn it down. His commanding officer with his hospital unit knew that he hadn't seen Alma and his youngest son, Roy, in almost 3 years. And he said, you know, play the age card. You can probably go home if you want, and I'll back you up. And Gericke thought about it. He was afraid that these were Hitler's henchmen. He didn't know that he wanted to meet them, but ultimately he decided that his desire to try to save the souls of these Nazis overrode his personal desire to go home.
And he actually thought he could do that.
He did. I think he probably hoped that he could. He didn't know what he was going to face, and he wrote later in a Saturday Evening Post article in the early 1950s. About his experience meeting these Nazis for the first time. And in a scene that's just sort of chilling, he's being introduced to them by the other chaplain, by O'Connor. And at some point, O'Connor, right before, actually, he meets the first Nazi, Rudolf Hess, O'Connor is called away. And so he's by himself, and he has to go into these cells by himself. There are guards around, but largely they're kind of ribbing Gericke at that point and seeing the fear on his face and saying, are you sure you want to do this, Chappie? But he does, and he described those meetings and then eventually came to know these men in the course of the following year.
And, of course, Hess, none of them could be accused of being of sound mind, but Hess in particular, there was a lot of thought that he was probably closer to insanity than some of the others.
Or he was a very good actor.
Well... All right, we have to take a break. We'll do that. Our guest is Tim Townsend. He's joining us from Washington. We're talking about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, An American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. The chaplain in this case is Henry Gericke. who spent a lot of time in St. Louis. He was a Missourian and spent a lot of time in St. Louis before joining the Army in his early 50s during the midpoint of World War II. Back to continue the conversation, if you'd like to get into it, feel free to do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email if you like at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you'd like to send us a tweet, we'll take that too at STL on Air. Back with Tim Townsend in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Tim Townsend, author of Mission at Nuremberg, an American Army chaplain and the trial of the Nazis. The chaplain in this case was a St. Louisan, Henry Gericke. But before we continue our conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri House could consider legislation today that would ask voters to impose a 1 cent sales tax for roads, bridges, and other transportation projects. Franklin County residents and others will have another chance to comment on a planned coal ash landfill next to Ameren, Missouri's Labadie Power Plant. A hearing hosted by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources will be held tonight at 7 in the town of Washington. It will focus on the utility's proposed permit to dispose of solid waste. And today is Election Day in Missouri. Voters are being asked to decide on local leaders, school board members, and tax and bond issues. There are very few high-profile races or issues on the ballot, but several school board races, including those in Normandy and Ferguson-Florissant, are being watched closely. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Tim Townsend. Before we proceed, Tim, let's just talk a little bit about Nuremberg as the site of the trial. Nuremberg, of course, is famous for the number of Nazi rallies that were held there prior to the war and in some cases during. So is that why Nuremberg was chosen?
No, Nuremberg was chosen really out of pragmatics, if that's a word. I don't even know if that's a word. They were. It was chosen because it was not as bombed out as the rest of the city and as the rest of a lot of cities' courtrooms. And they had a prison and a court that was essentially standing. And with just a little bit of repair, they could get something up. They could start the trials as fairly quickly. So. Despite its symbolic resonance as not only a place where Hitler had his rallies, these massive rallies that were made famous by Leni Riefenstahl, but the history of Nuremberg had a very strong strain of anti-Semitism, one of the reasons that Hitler was happy there. And so there was a lot of symbolic reasons to hold the trials there, but in the end, it was really infrastructure.
And the planning for these trials actually began long before the actual trials themselves.
Yeah, the Allies were talking about this quite a long time before the end of the war, despite Roosevelt really sort of being uncomfortable doing that. Again, there were pragmatic reasons for trying to figure out what they were going to do with these Nazis. And it went through a lot of stages of who was in charge of those conversations. And at one point, Churchill recommended that when they catch the biggest Nazis, they essentially make them say who they are and then just shoot them. And Roosevelt, for a time, was on board with that as a solution. And eventually, a few lawyers in his administration talked him out of it and said, you know, we should really think about something that would be a way for the world to watch justice being done for what these people, what the Nazis had attempted to do to the world. And so eventually Roosevelt came around and the Nuremberg trials, sort of the machinery of it, began to click, although it was really up until it started, there was a lot of back and forth about how it would be structured, how it would be just about the infrastructure of the trial, how translation would happen, who would get to have lawyers, would the men be on trial or the concepts of Nazism be on trial? So the entire thing was really an experiment.
And it's probably a pretty good that they decided to run the trials the way that they did, certainly in retrospect.
Yeah, and what was what was really interesting to find out is how much the optics, as they say here in D.C., mattered in the Nuremberg trials. Entire walls were taken out so that movie cameras could be installed and lights, Klieg lights, could be installed. When you see some of the Nazis in the dock wearing sunglasses, it's not because they wanted to keep their what they were thinking from attorneys. It's because of those Klieg lights. They were always in their eyes. And this was kind of the first a worldwide show. You know, this was something that it was so important that the Allies decided to try to broadcast it as widely as possible around the world and for history.
Your book, you mentioned, used the word chilling a little while ago in talking about the visit to the former concentration camp. I found the opening chapter of your book equally chilling when it talked about the execution of Wilhelm Keitel and one of the 21 who had been tried and found guilty. You really painted quite a vivid picture there, and it's something you wouldn't want to go through, certainly, but you wouldn't even want to witness.
No, and both of these, you know, that was one of the interesting things to me about finding this story and finding out more and more about the story is these were American Army chaplains who had just been through a war. They had no love for the Nazis, but over the course of a year, when you spend that much time with somebody, they did become close to some of these men, and so walking them to the gallows was probably difficult for both of them. And even the commandant of the prison, Colonel Burton Andress, who's been portrayed in some of the big Nazi movies before, and he was Garricky and O'Connor's boss. He walked each of the Nazis from the prison up to the gym door where the gallows were, but he wouldn't go through it. At the chaplains had to. They had to accompany each of these men who were being executed up the stairs of the gallows and pray with them in the seconds before they went through the trap door. But Andress, who was, and we talk about this in the book a little bit, who was very, he was very critical of Germany, not just Nazism, he couldn't do it. He couldn't go through the door and watch these Nazis die.
Yeah, I don't know many people who could, not many people that I know in any case. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the personalities that Garricky was exposed to. And the first one that comes to mind is Hermann Göring, who was headed the Hitler's Air Force and was, I guess, his number two guy. Interesting relationship between these two.
Yeah, Göring was by all accounts a very interesting character. He was Hitler's number two, as you said, but fell out of favor with Hitler toward the end of the war, really probably the last year or two, and yet he was hugely popular with the German people. They called him Der Dicke, the fat one, and he was immensely popular. He was also the person who set in motion the Final Solution. So you can be popular, but you can also be a monster, which is what Göring was. And yet in the prison, he was also popular. He was popular with the guards. He told jokes. He asked about baseball. He was very solicitous of conversation. And he was the leader of the Nazis within the prison. He tried to direct what they would and wouldn't say in court. And his relationship with Garricky was very close over the course of that year. He would come to all the chapel services. He would try to get the rest of the Nazis to come to the chapel services if they didn't want to go. And yet at the end of the book, there are a couple of scenes in which the differences between these two men, Garricky and Göring, are explicit, and some dramatic scenes at the end that have to do with Göring's suicide and Garricky's involvement with that.
Yes, we must mention the suicide for folks who really are not terribly familiar with this part of that history. The fact that Göring was able to commit suicide by taking cyanide, I guess, is still one of the great mysteries. Where did he get it, and how long did he have it, and why did he decide to cheat the hangman?
Yeah, he was as Gehrke wrote down, he was deathly afraid of being hanged. He thought it was not just a horrible way to die, because he had seen people die that way, but he thought it was a dishonorable way for a leader of the German people to die. And so, yeah, no one really knows for sure exactly how he obtained the potassium cyanide, but it was just hours before he was going to be executed with the rest of them that he took it, and was able to, in this incredibly secure atmosphere of Nuremberg, as you say, cheat the hangman.
You know, just going back to his attending worship services there in the prison, there was one line in your book in which you quote him as saying he was trying to convince the others to go to the chapel because it would make them look good.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing. He had ulterior motives for a lot of the things that he did and said. You know, he tried to portray himself as very concerned about some of the other condemned men who, Fritz Sauckel, for instance, who was the labor chief under Hitler, was he had just lost it by the time of the executions were coming around, and was just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing in his cell and screaming. And Göring would ask Gehrke, please let me help him. He has to be comforted in some way. And, you know, Gehrke probably thought that there was something more to that. Why did Göring at that point suddenly become such a humanitarian?
Mm-hmm. Getting back to Göring's suicide, Gehrke felt somehow that he had failed when Göring took his own life, that he had failed Göring. Why?
He did. In the days before, Gehrke knew that these executions were imminent, and in fact, the morning of the executions was told by Andrus. Both chaplains were told, you can't say anything about it, but it's happening at midnight tonight. And Gehrke, because he was, you know, laser focused on this mission of trying to save the souls of as many of these people as he could before they died, tried very hard in the last 2 days to convince Göring that he should accept Christ as his savior, and that he should come to Christianity in the last moments of his life and die correctly as a Christian. And Göring wouldn't do it. And they had this kind of back and forth that Gehrke later described in his writings. And at the very end, Göring sort of said, even though I don't really believe anything about what you say Christianity is, could I still have communion from you? And Gehrke took that as sort of a just in case you're right about Christianity. And in the end, the chaplain refused to give communion to a man he knew was about to die, even though he had spent the last year trying to make that happen. He just didn't believe that he had truly repented.
Do you think he might in any sense have had a feeling that Göring might attempt to take his own life?
I think that most of the people in the prison just would have thought that it would have been completely impossible given the atmosphere that they had lived in, this secure atmosphere that they had lived in for almost a year. So I don't think so. And in fact, the prison, all of the people involved in the prison were much more worried about some of the other prisoners than about Göring in terms of suicide, because people like Sauckel were just completely losing it at the end, and then other ones had been morose for days and just refusing to move. And I think they probably had more fear that one of them was going to try somehow to kill himself, but in the end it was Göring, and nobody was truly worried about him.
How were they monitored to prevent this kind of thing?
They were monitored. Someone had an eye on them every second of every day. So outside of each of their cells, the guards took turns of, I think, 30 minutes or 40 minutes each, just staring through a little hole in their cell, watching them. And the only time that they had any sort of a piece away from the eyes of someone was in the toilet behind a cell, and that's what people believe now. The investigators believe that Goering had hid the bullet case with the cyanide in it in a little part of the toilet that was hidden from view, and that's what he grabbed in those seconds before he went to sleep that night, and just minutes before he then eventually took the cyanide to end his life.
What a sensation that must have been, not only outside that prison, but within as well.
It's amazing to look at some of the newspaper headlines. I went back and looked at the Post-Dispatch headlines in the morgue, what we call the morgue, with all the old clips. And, you know, it's banner, huge front page news above the fold on that day in October 1946 that Goering, of all people, had managed to kill himself despite, you know, that was the last thing that anybody wanted and the Allies wanted. They wanted these men to, they wanted justice, and justice, it was felt, had been cheated by Hitler's number two.
And Goering probably was the best known out of all the defendants, I would suspect.
Oh, yeah. I think he was famous outside of Germany as well as inside. He was, I describe in the book some of his, you know, he was a character. He had his own train that had, you know, a bathtub in it, and he had wine and other food flown in to meet the train from Italy. And he was just one of those larger than life characters. And, you know, he had his own hunting ranch in the middle of Germany, and he would dress up as certain historical characters when other world leaders would come to visit. He was well known because I think he thought of himself as a sort of superstar. I think when he was the one to kill himself, it made the news that much bigger.
You're listening to Tim Townsend. He's the author of Mission at Nuremberg, an American Army Chaplain in the Trial of the Nazis. The chaplain in this case is Henry Gericke, a St. Louisan. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Again, if you'd like to be a part of it, 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Again, welcome back as we continue our conversation with Tim Townsend about his book, Mission at Nuremberg, an American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. Tim, if Gericke was close to Goering, who were others with whom he became close over those months?
Well, you mentioned Keitel before. He was Hitler's number one sort of general, field marshal, and he and Gericke did become close. Keitel was a little bit older, but they had the same number of sons who were about the same age also. But also, Keitel's kids were also had also fought in the war, although they had died, and Gericke's sons survived. They were both married to the daughters of brewers. Alma Gericke was the daughter of a St. Louis brewer, and they were from their families were from the same part of Germany, and in fact, as Keitel was climbing the gallows, he said a prayer when the two of them, their final prayer together, was a prayer that both of their mothers had said to them as little children in German. So they did have they had similarities, and Gericke believed that Keitel was one of the Nazis who truly did embrace his faith in the year that he was at Nuremberg. Gericke never talked about what happened in the confessional itself, and so we'll never know. He wouldn't even tell his sons years and years later what was said by these Nazis in the true kind of seal of the confessional way. But we do know that they were pretty close to each other, and there were others. Albert Speer was fairly close to Gericke. Baldur von Schirach, who was the Hitler Youth leader, Hans Fritzsche, who was actually acquitted. He was the propaganda chief under the radio propaganda chief under Goebbels. Also was close to Gericke, And some of the Catholics were close to O'Connor, too. Hans Frank, who was the governor general of Poland, nicknamed the Butcher of Krakow, probably sent more people to Auschwitz than anyone else, was very close to Father O'Connor. And O'Connor believed that Frank had made a true conversion back to the Catholic faith by the time he was hanged.
Yeah, it's important to point out that not all of the 21 were executed. Some were, in fact, acquitted. Not many, but a few.
Yeah, three, actually.
Yeah,
right.
Three. Let's go to the phones. We have a couple of people who want to get into this conversation, Tim. We'll start with Linda calling from Creve Coeur. Linda, go ahead.
Thank you. I've read the book. I find it very enlightening. And I wondered, he seemed very kind to the wives of the prisoners. Didn't he consider them complicit also?
That's a good question. Yeah, thank you, Linda, for buying the book. It was very important to both chaplains that the families of these Nazis be considered. So they went out of their way to try and find them. In a lot of cases, the prisoners didn't know where their families were. So they went out of their way, the chaplains, to find them. And then once they did, to keep the communication between the prisoners and their wives, and especially their children. I think they may have known that the wives probably knew a little more than they let on about what had been going on in Nazi Germany. But I think they felt that the children deserved food and shelter and to have some connection to their father, especially those men who were condemned to die. In the end, the chaplains petitioned the court to try to allow the families to come into the prison and see the condemned men, and they were successful. And so there was a lot of back and forth in the couple weeks between the sentencing and the executions themselves when the families would come in. And the prison became a little bit of a child care center. Gericke and O'Connor, watched the kids sometimes when the wives and husbands talked to each other.
You know, you also recount, I guess one of them, I hope I have my facts straight here, went to visit one of the wives and lo and behold, knocked on the door. And when the door was opened, it was by an American who was spending some time with the wife.
Yes, that's one of Hank Gericke, who is Henry Gericke's son, who lives in Cape Girardeau. He's the former chief of police in Cape. And he was instrumental in helping me tell some of that color in the book. That's one of his favorite stories, this was one of the witnesses, not the 21, but there were in the second tier of the prison, there were the witnesses that they were still German POWs, but these were men who were testifying against the major Nazi war criminals, or for them, I suppose. But yes, Gericke was asked by one of the witnesses to go and see if his wife was okay. And Gericke went, and an American GI opened the door and said, and Gericke said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I must have the wrong address." And he said, "Who are you?" The GI said, "Who are you looking for?" And Gericke said, "Nope, she's here and she's just fine. Thanks, Chappie." Well, and Gericke went back and told the man that his wife was doing just fine.
Well, when they make the movie, I think that's going to get it's going to be the big scene.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. Art joins us from South St. Louis. Go ahead, Art.
You know, I take a great deal of interest in what went on over there, and especially when Walter Cronkite wrote up his autobiography with respect to Goring. He said Goring really made a fool out of that Judge Jackson, and that he was really more knowledgeable on all the facts and instances than the judges were. And then the other thing was Albert Goring, the brother to Hermann Goring. He was down in Italy. He was setting up a train for refugees, for Jewish immigrants, clearing them with Hermann Goring's signature in his name and so forth like that. And I guess the thing of it is I'm sort of wondering with respect to what happened to, what is his name now? The threats, were there any threats on his side?
Art, I'm going to interrupt you. The line that you're on is awful. We can barely hear you, but I did hear you say, were there any threats against Garrick? I'm sure is what you're trying to get to. And in fact, there were, Tim.
There. When he came home, Garrick, as I mentioned, wrote a little bit about his time at Nuremberg in the Saturday Evening Post. And I don't think most people had really any clue that the Allies had provided these men with chaplains. There are some instances in some of the clips, newspaper clips, during the course of the trials you can find where reporters would ask the chaplains what these men were reading or what they were thinking on Easter or something. But by and large, I don't think most people knew that we had done this, the Allies had done this. And so Garrick wrote about it in a big splashy way in the Saturday Evening Post and wrote about shaking hands the first time he met Rudolf Hess and Hermann Göring. And, you know, this was probably 5 or 6 years after the war. And to most people, that was repulsive to even touch one of these people. And so he got a lot of hate mail. People called him a Nazi lover and an anti-Semite, and that was difficult for him. When he died, his son, Hank, who I mentioned before, was going through his desk and found a sort of secret compartment in the back, and behind it was all of this hate mail. For some reason, he had kept it all, nobody will know why, but he did receive criticism. I don't know if there was threats so much, but definitely criticism for what he did.
This whole exercise of providing chaplains for these men charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity is called something of an experiment. I mean, obviously nothing like this had happened before, but what was the dynamic of that, of the decision to use the chaplains as they did?
Yeah, I went back through one of the chapters in the book is about the history of military chaplaincy. And especially the history of American military chaplaincy. And I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, where today's military chaplains are trained, and talked to historians there who told me that this had never been done before. And there had been instances where, typically what happens with the Geneva Conventions, state that POWs must be offered some sort of spiritual guidance if they request it. Typically that was done in just by assigning one of the prisoners of war who happened to be ordained as the chaplain to his fellow inmates. But the security was such at Nuremberg that they just didn't trust a German chaplain to do that. And so that's why they decided to bring in two of their own to do this job that had never been done before.
Wouldn't that suggest, though, the fact that they wanted to keep all the Germans out, that it must have been an American who provided the cyanide for Göring?
Well, that's what the best book on the Göring suicide was written probably 15 years ago by a school teacher in Texas. And he had spent, I don't know how many years, but years and years and years looking at the evidence and the investigations and interviewing as many people as were still around. And his conclusion at the end of the book, which is what I think most historians agree with now, is that indeed it was one of the guards named Tex Wheeler who liked Göring and somehow may have gone into his valise, which was amazingly they kept all of the Nazis' stuff, all their suitcases or whatever they had when they were caught, they kept them in one of the cells nearby. Huh. The thinking is that he may have gone into the valise in that cell. Every Nazi officer was given potassium cyanide tablets at the end of the war. And so found one for Göring and snuck it to him at the last minute. And that's what he used.
Was there a suggestion of a payoff of some sort or just a compassionate action?
I think there was probably, there was not a lot that Göring had at that point. He did give away some of his stuff. One of the things, the amazing parts of my research that I found was that when the trials were over, Garrick left to go back to the States, and stopped in Frankfurt because Hank had been injured and he was in the hospital. When he got to Frankfurt, he got off of the train, and some kids took his suitcase from him and ran away. And eventually the military police officers found the suitcase in the rail yard, open but empty, save for a few things that Garrickey had. Most of what was empty were his notes. He had planned to write this book himself, but all of it was gone. And one of the things that wasn't gone was a pair of gloves of Goring's that he had given to Garrickey as a thank you at some point. And those are actually now in the Chaplin Museum in Fort Jackson as part of a display.
Now, Goering had a lot of artwork and things of that nature stashed across Europe, too. I suppose he could have directed someone toward some of that.
That's true. If there was a way for... I think it was very tough at that point to communicate with the outside world. I think Andrus tried to make that impossible for them. But, you know, people find ways to do it, so who knows?
Of course, this didn't last forever, and when the trials were over, Henry Garrickey came back here and continued with his ministry in the world of prisons and prisoners.
He did. His immediate job when he was in the reserves was at a disciplinary barracks in Milwaukee, where he was for a couple years, and then when he was discharged, he and Alma moved to Chester, Illinois, right across the river, and moved into a small church, St. John's Lutheran Church. He was an assistant chaplain, assistant pastor there. But the real reason he went was to be a chaplain at Menard, which is a maximum security prison in Illinois. And he spent the last part of his life as a chaplain to murderers and rapists and, you know, the worst of the worst in our country. For some reason he was drawn to that kind of ministry.
What do we know about it? We've got a couple of minutes left. What do we know about his time at Menard and how he dealt with these people?
It was very similar, actually, I think, in a lot of ways. He went in probably a little nervous. In the end, though, it became his community. He was revered there, and he struck up a friendship with the former governor of Illinois who... he wasn't the governor. He was, there's so many governors of Illinois in jail,
right?
In the history. This was, I think he might've been a treasurer or something like that, but, the Chicago Sun-Times had won a Pulitzer taking this guy down for some sort of graft. And, he was, one of the prisoners, and he happened to be a great communicator. And so he and Garrickey worked together. Garrickey brought him around to Christianity, and Garrickey worked together to form this kind of Christian community within the penitentiary. The warden, it also happened to be, was also an evangelical Christian, so made it easier. But they started a Christian radio show, within the prison that was piped into your cell no matter what, if you wanted it or not. And by the end of his life, he was, as I said, a revered figure in this prison, with these horrible criminals.
You mentioned the radio show, and I have to go back to Nuremberg because kind of a behind the scenes backdrop to all that was going on during these trials was the fact that a World Series was going on during part of this time, and you can tell us who was playing and how that was affecting our chaplain friends.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing that the World Series in 1946 was the Red Sox and the Cardinals, and it just happened to be right around the time of the executions. And so the night of the executions, the Palace of Justice, where the court and the prison was locked down, and the two chaplains, O'Connor was actually a Dodgers fan. But he took the Red Sox against Garrickey's Cardinals, and they had a $10 bet on that game that night. And the way that they would get the score, because it was on communication lockdown, every half inning, somebody would call from the outside into the guard booth in the prison, and all the guards and the chaplains would rush around to get the half inning score. And right in the middle of that was when one of the guards screamed that there was something going on in Goring's cell, and Garrickey ran from the guard booth, and he was the first one to get to Goring after he took the cyanide.
Got to leave it at that point. I'm interested in the fact that the two chaplains had a $10 bet. That is interesting. Tim Townsend, thanks so much for being with us. Mission at Nuremberg is the book, An American Army Chaplain and the Trial of the Nazis. Enjoyed talking to you. Enjoyed the book. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Don.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the prevention of child abuse, treatment for abused children, and a citywide effort to raise awareness of this issue. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This program is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.